Hi, and welcome to 20 Lessons Podcast. It's been a bit since our last one, but I'm really excited to share this one with you. We're going to talk about Jewish holidays today, the Jewish holiday cycle, and it's only appropriate that we start with a quick story. Jewish parents, Jewish mom and a dad, they're living in Florida, and they call their son in New York, and the father says, "Son, I hate to tell you this, but your mom and I, we're getting a divorce. We want to live out the rest of our lives in peace." Before the son has a chance to respond, the father hangs up. The son immediately calls his sister living in New Jersey and tells her the news. The sister says, "I'll handle this." She immediately calls her father and says, "Don't do anything till we get there. We'll be there Friday." The father says, all right already. And they put down the phone. As the father puts down the phone, he turns to his wife and he says, "Honey, our kids are coming for the holidays." So the holidays are an extremely important part of what it means to be Jewish. They are, for many, they are the very cornerstone of our Judaism, celebrating those holidays together with our families. So now I want to talk a little bit about that. In order to talk about the holidays, I think it's important to understand how it is that time works in Judaism. So the first idea I want to share is a spiritual idea. In Judaism, we believe that there's a physical world. And then there's a physical existence. And then there's an emotional, mental existence, which lives beyond the physical, right? It's not concrete. It's not something you can feel, but it's certainly there. And then, of course, there's a spiritual layer as well. There's a spiritual layer to our existence. Again, it goes beyond the physical, but it is there. And just like our physical world reacts to stimuli and our emotional and mental world existence reacts to stimuli, so too does our spiritual world. And as we'll see, they're all interrelated. We believe in a holistic view of a human being and of the world itself that's made up and interreacts all four of these layers: the physical, the spirit, the emotional, the mental, and the spiritual. So when we talk about holidays, the festivals in Judaism, we're not just talking about commemorations. So on Passover, we're not just remembering that our ancestors were slaves in Egypt and God took us out, but rather we believe that there is a special energy, almost a light, a divine light that is accessible to us throughout Passover, which we have the ability to tap into and experience this light or energy of freedom, especially in our lives, and truly experience freedom in our own lives. We all could use some sort of freedom from something that's keeping us back. And Pesach does not just commemorate the freedom that our ancestors received thousands of years ago, but in turn it allows us to tap into a special energy of freedom that came into the world during Pesach thousands of years ago, but is now here for our taking, for us to connect to every time we reach this point in the year. So in other words, if time was a linear thing in Judaism, then we would be just commemorating because it'd be linear. Time would be linear. We'd be commemorating. But we see time as cyclical, and that would mean then that we can re-experience that very energy that we experienced the first time, which on Passover was about freedom. Now, of course, in order for us to really experience that type of energy, to experience that cyclical nature and time, we do have to be open to it. We'll have a lot better chance connecting to it. So that's the first point. Time is not linear, rather cyclical in Judaism. And there's that certain light or energy that came into the world at some point in time. And as we travel around the circle of the year, we kind of re-access, we reunite with that energy at the same time every year. Now, before we talk more about the Jewish holidays, let's talk about how it is the Jewish calendar works. So, at first glance, it would seem that the Jewish calendar works based off of a solar calendar. Based off a lunar calendar. So let's just quickly talk about what a solar calendar is and what a lunar calendar is. A solar calendar is the calendar that we use in our secular lives. What is a solar calendar? It's the Earth's revolution around the sun. In other words, it takes the Earth 365 days to circle around the sun. It's in this 365-day solar calendar where we have four seasons. So it's with a 365-day year that we get these four seasons, and each month is always in the same season. So in other words, April is always in the spring, and February is always in the winter every single year, because that's how it works when you use the solar calendar. The other option for a calendar would be the lunar calendar. What is a lunar calendar? So the lunar calendar is the moon going around the Earth 12 times. So the moon goes around the Earth 12 times over a period of 354 days. That is the would be the lunar calendar. It'd be a 354-day calendar. And of course, if you use the lunar calendar, then you will not have seasonal months. In other words, if your months are based on just a lunar calendar, then your month of April could fall out during any season, and so too with your month of February, and so on and so forth. There would be no seasons that would correlate to your calendar. So Christians keep the solar calendar. Their religion is completely based off the solar calendar, which means then that their holidays are always at the same time of the year, which means that Christmas is always in the winter and Easter is always in the spring, and so on and so forth. Muslims, they rely on completely a lunar calendar, a 354-day calendar, which means that their holidays and their months are constantly fluctuating as to which season they are in. So for instance, we're at the beginning of Ramadan, and Ramadan will be 11 days earlier each year versus the solar calendar, which means that Ramadan can end up being in the summer, spring, fall, or winter. So that's how it would work with a lunar calendar. So the question is how does the Jewish calendar work? Is the Jewish calendar like the Christian solar calendar, or like the Muslim lunar calendar? And the answer is that we actually have a little bit of both. We're a solar lunar calendar. So we're a lunar calendar as far as how we decide as far as our months go. So let's talk about this for a moment. The Hebrew word for month is chodesh. What is the word chodesh means? It's the same word as chadash, which means new. In other words, our new month begins when we see the new moon. Now, obviously, it's not a new moon. It's not like the moon goes away and then comes back, and then now there's a new moon. It's once we can see the moon again. So after having gone completely unnoticeable at the end of last month. In other words, the beginning of a new Jewish month is completely determined based on the seeing of the moon, that first little sliver of the moon that happens at the beginning of the month, right? Because that's how the moon waxes and wanes. It's at its largest in the middle of the month on day 15. Then it gets smaller and smaller and smaller until basically it disappears until you can see that first sliver again. And it's at that point of the first sliver that the new Jewish month begins. And it used to be that it was completely determined based on when somebody would see that new sliver of the moon. It used to be that a new month was declared by the Sanhedrin, by the great court, the Supreme Court in Jerusalem, when a witness would come and attest to having seen the new moon. Nowadays, we don't decide our Jewish months like that. We still rely on the lunar calendar, but we have a set calendar. We know when the moon will reveal itself again. We have that set for thousands of years going forward, forever going forward, and we rely on our set calendar, but it is still completely dependent on when the new moon reappears. So we are, in that way, we definitely are a lunar calendar. Just to point out for just a moment, a Jewish month sometimes has 29 days and sometimes it has 30 days. Why is that? Why is it that some Jewish months have 29 and some 30? Well, if you take a look at a precise lunar month, the precise time it takes for the moon to orbit around the Earth, you will find that it actually takes 29 and a half days, which would then mean that the beginning of a new month should actually happen in the middle of the day. But we don't do that. We have the beginning of a month have start at the beginning of a day, which in Judaism is the night before. But we make up for those half days by having half of the month Jewish months are 29 days, and half of the Jewish months are 30 days. So we end up incorporating 12 months of 29 and a half days each, but instead we do 6:29 and 6:30. So far it sounds like we have an absolute calendar. But we also know that our holidays are at the same time every year. So Hanukkah is always in the winter, and Pesach, Passover, is always in the spring, and so on and so forth. So how in the world does that work if we go with a lunar calendar? So for that, that's what I meant when I said that we are also a solar calendar, meaning the seasons are very important to us. In fact, the Torah tells us very clearly that we have to make sure the Sanhedrin, the great court in Jerusalem that used to decide the months, and now we have to make sure that Passover always happens in the spring. Why? Well, this will take us back to that first idea I shared of the multiple layers of a human existence, physical, mental, emotional, spiritual. And we would best experience the freedom that is accessible to us when our physical surroundings as well reflect that type of freedom. And when does that happen? That happens in the spring. That's when we come outdoors from after being inside for so long. We have that freedom of going outside, unbundling ourselves. Trees are blooming. The trees are escaping. The trees are experiencing freedom. The flowers, the fruits, and everything. So being that we are these multifaceted beings, everything is interrelated. The Torah mandates that Passover, the holiday of freedom, happen at a time where the physical reality manifests, expresses that freedom. So what do we do? So if that's the case, how do we keep the holidays in their seasons? How do we make sure that Passover happens in the spring using a lunar calendar? So that's where we have the idea of a leap year, a Jewish leap year. What a Jewish leap year is that that seven times in 19 years, we add an extra month to the Jewish calendar. The last month of the Jewish calendar, according to this cycle, would be the Jewish month, the Hebrew month of Adar, which is when Purim falls out in. The holiday of Purim, which we'll talk about soon. And what we do is seven times over 19 years, we add a second Adar, what's known as an Adar Bet. An Adar Bet is the second Adar. And by adding an extra month, an extra 30 days to our calendar around every 3 years, that allows us to catch up to the solar calendar, because every year the lunar calendar has 11 days less than the solar calendar. So if we add about 30 days every 3 and something years, we'll end up being able to keep consistent with the solar calendar. So that's basically how it works. So we have a lunar solar calendar where our months are determined by the moon, but we also make sure that we keep up with the solar calendar by adding an extra month of the year, seven times in every 19 years. So now we know how Jewish time works. It's cyclical, not linear. That's a spiritual concept. We know how our calendar works. We know how we make new months. And we're doing pretty well. Just by the way, I do want to point out that every first day of the new month, which is known as, we refer to it as Rosh Chodesh, which is the first of the month. Rosh means head, so the head of the month. Each Rosh Chodesh is a mini festival in of its own, where we do add some extra joyous prayers, and we treat it with a little bit more of a festive type of nature. Okay, let's now talk about the major Jewish holidays, though. So today we're going to talk about the festivals, the Jewish festivals, and then our next podcast is going to be about the Jewish fast days. So let's take a look at 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 holidays today. We're going to take a look at what we refer to as the Shalosh Regalim, which are the three pilgrimage festivals. We're going to take a look at Rosh Hashanah. We're going to take a look at Yom Kippur, some parts of Yom Kippur, because as we know, Yom Kippur is both a festival but also a fast day, so it really belongs in both of the podcasts. And then we're going to take a look at the two rabbinic festivals, not biblical, so you won't find them in the Torah. They happened later on in Jewish history, and those are Hanukkah and Purim. So let's start with the pilgrimage festivals. What are we referring to? So in Judaism, we refer to festivals in several different ways. One way is the word chag, which is a day of rejoicing. Chogeg is to rejoice. It's a day of rejoicing. The festivals are the happiest times of the year. Another way is Yom Tov, right? A good day, right? We'll wish each other chag sameach, or good Yom Tov, which is good Yom Tov, a good day. Now, interestingly, the first time that the just interesting that when God is when the when so the it's interesting the first time that the word tov, good, is used in the Torah is in reference to light, when God creates the light. It says Vayar Elokim es ha'or ki tov, God saw the light and it was good. And it's interesting that we refer to our holidays as a day of good, which would bring us back to that time of light, and which fits in well with what I was describing, that holidays have these special light, the special light or energy for us to tap into. Okay, so those are two ways of referring to holidays. But now I want to go to two other ways of referring to holidays. One is called a moed. A moed is a meeting point. So perhaps it's the idea that this is the time of the year when we really meet with God, we rendezvous with God. But it's also used in the context of the pilgrimage, the mandated pilgrimage to the temples in Jerusalem, which is the dwelling place of the divine in this world. So let's now talk about what this means, a pilgrimage festival, which will bring us to the fourth way that we refer to a holiday, which is the word regel. Regel is a holiday, but it also means a leg. In other words, a reference to a pilgrimage, because three times a year, the Jewish people as a collective are commanded, are obligated to make a pilgrimage to the temple in Jerusalem and bring special festival offerings. It was this massive Jewish reunion with God and fellow Jews from all over the year, three times a year. And those three times of the year were Passover, Pesach, Shavuot, the holiday of Shavuot, and the holiday of Sukkot. And that's, let's talk about those three holidays first. So the first thing to know about those three holidays is that they were pilgrimage festivals, regalim, where we were commanded to go up to the temple in Jerusalem. And you can only imagine how ecstatic and thrilling and joyful that must have been. We'll start. An interesting thing about these three festivals is that all three of them mark an event on the agricultural cycle, and it's important for us to recall that when the Torah was given for many thousands of years, societies were very agrarian societies, where agriculture was a huge, it took up most people, it was the career of most people, it was most, took up the days of most people. So it's interesting to point out that these three festivals do mark very significant events on the agricultural cycle, but they also mark in a historical event, a very important historical event, and in turn allow us to tap into that energy that shined down during those historical events. So the first one we have is Passover, Pesach. Passover is the English word for Pesach, reference to God passing over the homes of the Jewish people during the 10th plague that was brought upon the Egyptians. Pesach is the time that the produce would begin to ripen. In fact, that was the indicator. Is Pesach in the spring? The Sanhedrin will have to decide, do we add a month or not? To make sure Pesach is in the spring, and they would look to see if the barley was ripe or not. That's how they would decide, to see if an extra month was necessary. But let's focus on the historical point of Pesach. So the Jewish people were in Egypt for 210 years. God hears the cries of the Jewish people, appoints Moses, Moshe, to take the Jewish people out, brings 10 plagues, the Exodus happens, the splitting of the Sea of Reeds, the drowning of the Egyptians, the Jewish people become a nation at that point. That is the commemoration of Passover. Passover, we have 7 days of Passover in the Torah. Pesach is a 7-day festival in the Torah. The seventh day, by the way, of Pesach is when the splitting of the sea happens. So we have a 7-day festival. The first day of the festival looks very similar to Shabbat as far as forbidden labor is concerned. However, there is a major exception. One of the major exceptions is that cooking, at least as long as it's from a pre-existing flame that existed before the holiday, you're allowed to cook on a major day of the festival, which you are not allowed to do on Shabbat. So what we have is, we have the first day of the festival of Pesach, which is a major day. The first evening of that festival, we have a Seder. The word Seder means an order. It's an ordered evening of 15 steps. Each step of the Seder can be explained as a step toward personal freedom. But the real point of the Seder is something absolutely incredible. And I like to describe it with the following little story or a little idea. So in 1959, the Dalai Lama, his life was in danger, and he fled to Dharamsala in India from Tibet, where he and many of his followers have lived ever since. And he realized that their stay in exile might be prolonged, so he decided to ask the Jews, who he regarded as the world's experts in maintaining identity in exile, for some advice. How are we supposed to keep our unique identity alive when we are in exile? And how do we make sure our children do that and our children's children and so on and so forth? He wanted to know the secret. And the story of that week-long encounter between the Dalai Lama and the Jewish community, you can read about it in the book, The Jew and the Lotus. But one of the things, and one of the focal things that was shared with him and which really touched him, was the importance of memory and storytelling in keeping a people's culture and identity alive. And that's why Pesach, the Passover holiday, specifically the Seder, touched the Dalai Lama more than anything else had touched him. And in 1997, rabbis and American dignitaries, they held a special Seder service. They had a special Seder service in Washington, D.C. with the Dalai Lama. And he wrote the following to the participants. He said, "In our dialogue with rabbis and Jewish scholars, the Tibetan people have learned about the secrets of Jewish spiritual survival in exile. One of the main secrets is the Passover Seder. Through it, for 2,000 years, even in very difficult times, Jewish people remember their liberation from slavery to freedom. And this has brought you hope in times of difficulty. The Seder is about sharing our story and therefore giving purpose to the lives of the next generation. But we do it in an interactive way through questions and answers. In fact, we're obligated to do it through questions and answers and inspiring questions and answers. And we do it with concrete props. We do it with bitter herbs to remind us. We eat bitter herbs to remind us of the bitterness. We eat matzah. By the way, throughout all of Pesach, we cannot eat any leavened products, no chametz. But on the Seder night, we are obligated to eat matzah, which is the food that represents the haste at which the Jewish people left Egypt. We drink 4 cups of wine, representing the 4 languages of freedom used in the Exodus story in the Torah and the Bible. We have a Seder plate with a whole bunch of interesting things, and it becomes this reenactment, this storytelling to the next generation of our story, thereby giving the next generation purpose and a heritage and an identity which couldn't be more important. And then after that first major day of the holiday, we then have what is called Chol HaMoed, which are intermediate days of the festival. They have much more limited prohibition as far as forbidden labor, but they still maintain unique festival identity. And then you would have the last day of the festival, which has the same stringencies as the first day. It's another major day of the festival. So that is how the Torah tells us to celebrate Passover. It's a 7-day festival, and so is it celebrated in Israel to this very day. But the moment you take a step outside of the land of Israel, the state of Israel, you find a very different reality. You find that Passover is actually celebrated for 8 days, not 7 days. And not only is it celebrated for 8 days, but instead of one major festival day at the beginning, we have 2 major festival days at the beginning. And instead of one Seder at the beginning, we have 2 Seders. The first 2 nights we have Seders. And then we have 4 intermediate days, because instead of one major festival day at the end, we have 2 major festival days at the end. So we end up having an 8-day festival, and it looks very different than Israel's celebration of Passover. And the question is what in the world is going on? Why do we have an extra day of the holiday? 2 extra days of full-fledged holidays akin to Shabbat in the beginning, 2 at the end, and 2 Seders. So perhaps it points to how being in Israel makes you more spiritually receptive, and everything you need to get from the holiday you can get quicker being in Israel because you're more spiritually attuned. So you only need 7 days instead of 8 days. You only need two, one at the beginning, one at the end, major days of the festival instead of four, and so on and so forth. But the main idea as to why it is we celebrate Passover differently in Israel than we do in the diaspora goes back thousands of years. You remember how I said that back in the day, thousands of years ago, before the destruction of the Second Temple in Jerusalem, which happened in the year 70 of the Common Era, before that, we explained that a new month was decided based on human testimony to the Sanhedrin, to the Supreme Court in Jerusalem. Now, something to bear in mind is that every month, every lunar month, could theoretically be either, which would mean then that every month could be an either 29-day month or 30-day month. So how would that work? So if you have a witness that comes on the 30th day of the month and says, "I saw the moon," then and they're interrogated and it seems that their testimony is accurate and true, then that 30th day of the month becomes the first day of the next month. But what happens if it's extremely cloudy on the 30th day, the night of the 30th? What happens if it's extremely cloudy and therefore no one was able to see the moon? Then what happens? So we say that if no witnesses came on the 30th day, then automatically the 31st day of the month becomes the first day of the new month, which then means that the first day of Rosh Chodesh, the first day of the new month, could either be on the day 30th of the last month or the day 31 of the last month. And of course, depending on which day is the first day of the new month, that would completely determine what day is the first day of the festivals, the festival of Passover. So let's just use Passover for right now. So for instance, Passover is begins on the night of the 15th of Nisan, which means that if day one is the 30th day, let's say that's a Monday, the 30th day of the last month becomes day one, which would mean then that Rosh Chodesh, day one of the new month, and that's the month of Nisan, is on a Monday, which means then that the 15th of that new month, the 15th of that month, which would be Pesach, would end up coming out on Monday 2 weeks, 2 weeks later. Right? That's what we're up to? Monday, Sunday. Yeah, Monday 2 weeks later. If Rosh Chodesh, if the first day of the new month of Nisan, isn't until the 31st day of the last month, that would mean then that the first day is Tuesday of the new month, which would mean then that Pesach would begin on a Tuesday. Now, that's all fine and dandy if you live in Israel, because word can spread in Israel throughout all of Israel within 5 days. So if Monday ends up being the day that's announced as the new month, then within 5 days, everybody would know that, and everybody would know to begin Passover on Monday the 15th of Nisan. But what happens if you live outside of Israel, way outside of Israel, where it can take a month, let's say, to get word out as to which day was the first day of the new month? Then you're really not sure what day Pesach starts as, which day Passover begins. This Passover begin was Rosh Chodesh, was the first day of the new month, on the Monday, the 30th day of the last month, or was it on the Tuesday, the 31st day of the last month? Which would then mean that does Passover start on Monday or Tuesday 2 weeks later? And now you're starting to get into a very complicated territory. Because if Passover started on that Monday, and you began your Passover on that Monday, then you would be, and then you celebrated 7 days, you would have been good to go. But what happens if Passover didn't start till that Tuesday? Then what you would end up having is you would have celebrated Passover on Monday, you would have done 7 days, and then the last day, that on the eighth day of Passover, which you wouldn't have celebrated because you only celebrate 7 days of the holiday because that's what the Torah tells you to do. But really, that eighth day is actually still Passover because you started Passover a day earlier, which then means that you would be eating bagels and challah and bread on Passover itself, which is a transgression of a very great prohibition. Furthermore, what would end up happening is that you would have had your Seder Monday night. Passover didn't really start Monday night. So you would have really done a fake Seder. You would have ended up with a mock Seder instead of having your Seder the first night of Passover, which really would have been Tuesday, and you would have lost out on your fulfillment of the actual mitzvah to make a Seder and to have 4 cups of wine and to eat matzah and so on and so forth. And think of all of the complications that would come for all of those that didn't live within Israel, so were not told on time as to which day the first day of the new month was. So what ended up happening was, is back when months were decided in this way, and therefore holidays were determined based on this, the rule became is that if you live in Israel, you'd find out within 5 days as to when the new month was. You'd know with absolute certainty when a festival would fall out. But if you live in the diaspora, because you would not know with absolute certainty, you may not know with absolute certainty till the festival has long passed. What we end up saying is you have to make an 8-day festival. So the first day of the festival becomes 2 days because you're not sure which one is the first day. Which one do you need to do the Seder on to fulfill the mitzvah of the Seder? Which one is the day that it needs to be treated like a major holiday, similar to Shabbat, with keeping away from forbidden labor? So you end up having to have two of those because you're not sure which one it is. And then you have 4 days of the Chol HaMoed, of intermediate days. And then when you get to the seventh day of the festival, you have exactly the same question. Which day is the seventh day of the festival? Which day do I have to keep away from forbidden labor? So because of that doubt, because you're not sure, you end up having to do 2 days of that as well. Hence, the diaspora festival looking very different, where you have 2 major days of the festival at the beginning, 4 intermediate days, and 2 major days of the festival at the end, in order that diaspora Jews don't get anything wrong when it comes to the festivals. So that's the idea here. So hence, today, we live in the diaspora, so we have 2 days of the festival at the beginning, major days, 4 intermediate days, 2 days at the end, and of course we also have 2 Seders. So that's just a very brief synopsis of how it came about that Israel and the diaspora end up celebrating these holidays in a different fashion. Okay, let's go on to the second pilgrimage festival. This is the holiday of Shavuot. So on the second night of Passover, the second night of Pesach, we begin a count. This count is known as Sfirat HaOmer, the counting of the Omer. What's the Omer? The Omer was a barley offering brought on the second day of the festival. And then you would count for 49 days, and 49 days later would end the Omer period. And on the 50th day, that is the day of Shavuot. What is Shavuot about? Shavuot is the day in which the Jewish people received the Torah at Mount Sinai. So what do we have here? We end up having that we begin counting 49 days from the second day of Passover. It reflects the 49-day period from when the Israelites left Egypt until they stood at the foot of Mount Sinai and received the Torah and the Ten Commandments on the 50th day. And then we have Shavuot, which is a celebration of having received the Torah. It's the yearly anniversary of having received the Torah 3,333 years ago. Now, just an aside, before we talk more about Shavuot, I just want to share a minor festival that occurs during this Omer period, the 49-day counting period. During this 49-day period, we have one day which is called Lag BaOmer. Lag, L-A-G, in Hebrew is the letter Lamed and the letter Gimel. The numerical value of Lamed is 30. The numerical value of Gimel is 3. So it's the 33rd day of the Omer. Lag BaOmer, the 33rd day of the Omer. And why is that a little bit of a festival? Well, during the Omer period, the 49-day period, for 33 days during the Omer period, we experience a certain sort of mourning, like mourning, a sad mourning. So we don't cut our hair. We don't listen to music. We abstain from a couple of things that basically put us in a little bit of a mindset of mourning. Why are we mourning during this period? Because there was a very devastating point in history when the students of the great Rabbi Akiva, the leaders of the generation, 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva, they all died during this time. The reason for their death is a bit unclear, and not for now, but they died during this period. And they only stopped dying on Lag BaOmer, on the 33rd day of the Omer itself. So that day basically became a day of relief, became a day of rebuilding, and it was at that point in time that Judaism basically had to rebuild with the loss of 24,000 students. But it was a day of relief, so we take a little bit of a relief day on that day from the mourning customs. But it also has become a day of celebration. So why has it become a day of celebration? Because it's the yahrzeit of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. The yahrzeit is the day of the anniversary of the death, the day of the death of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. And he asked that this day be a day of the celebration of his contributions. Who is Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai? One of the greatest sages ever in Jewish history. With many unique contributions, but most important of them was the writing of the Zohar. The Zohar, what is the foundational work of Jewish mysticism? It's truly the foundation of Jewish mysticism. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai wrote that. So on his anniversary of his death, he asked that celebrations be had, and so we do going forward. So the Omer time is a time where we reflect on having left Egypt and then working on ourselves to be worthy of receiving the Torah on Mount Sinai. So it's a time of growth. Each day we focus on another one of the many attributes of the human being and working on it and growing in that way. And it's also a time that's underlined with an underlying kind of sense of Jewish mysticism attached to it. Okay, now we get to Shavuot. We're done with counting the Omer. We get to Shavuot. Shavuot is the day that we enter this covenant with God, receive the Torah, sight unseen. The Jewish people said, Nasa v'nishma, we'll do and then we'll hear, meaning we're all in. Moses is confirmed as God's prophet at that point. We receive the Torah. It's like the wedding day between the Jewish people and God. The word Shavuot means weeks, a reference to this idea that we've just finished counting 7 weeks. Sheva, also of that word Shavuot, 7 weeks to get us to this point. And also Shavuot means an oath, a reference to that oath we took in our marriage with God. Now in Israel, it's a one-day festival. In the diaspora, it's a two-day festival, same idea as Passover. We're not sure which day it is, so we end up doing a two-day festival. On Shavuot, we read the Ten Commandments from the Torah from the Torah portion of Yisro. So we read the Ten Commandments on Shavuot, which would make a lot of sense because that's the day we receive the Ten Commandments. And we also have another interesting reading on Shavuot. We read the Megillah of Ruth, the part of the Hebrew Bible that tells us the story of Ruth, a Midianite princess she was a Midianite princess who marries a Jewish man. Her husband dies, leaving her with her Jewish mother-in-law, who at that point decides to return to Israel. Ruth herself is not Jewish, and although her mother-in-law discourages her from accompanying her on her return to Israel, Ruth will hear nothing of it. Her dedication and loyalty to her mother-in-law is unbelievable, and she ends up coming with her. She ends up converting. She ends up becoming Jewish, and after a sequence of events, she bears a child from a great Jewish leader of the time. His name was Boaz, and her grandchild ends up being King David, the father of the Davidic dynasty, the royal dynasty of the Jewish people. Eventually, God willing, soon, the father of the Messiah, the father of Mashiach, the great-great-great-great-grandfather, obviously. And interestingly, King David's yahrzeit is actually on Shavuot. Now, Shavuot doesn't have any specific mitzvot attached to it, right? When we spoke about Passover, we spoke about the matzah and the wine and the seder and so on and so forth. Shavuot doesn't have any specific mitzvah attached to it. And the idea would be is that it represents the totality of the relationship with God. Not action, not words, not anything specific. The totality of the relationship with God, which is just our being. You take a look at the Ten Commandments given on Shavuot. The first five are commandments between us and God, and the second five are between humanity, human beings, interactions between human beings, and they incorporate thought, speech, and action, both the first half and second half as well, as if to reference the totality of our relationship with God. Although there are no special mitzvot, actual mitzvot for Shavuot, there are some minhagim, there are some customs that have become, that have that we do on Shavuot. One of them is having a dairy meal. The Hebrew word for dairy is chalav. Chalav's numerical value is 40. Moses was up on Mount Sinai receiving the Torah for 40 days and 40 nights. Furthermore, we know that milk nourishes a baby, is the only thing that a baby needs to be nourished. So we basically are sharing the same thing, that the only thing that we need to be nourished is the Torah. Furthermore, is that another reason for dairy, and this will be the last one I'll share, is that when we receive the Torah, we basically received all of these complex laws as to how to make kosher meat, how to be able to eat meat while it being kosher, so slaughtering and so on and so forth. So you can imagine that on that day, we were just beginning to learn the laws of the of how to prepare meat for it to be kosher. All we really had accessible for us then was dairy. So just like their first meal after receiving the Torah would have been dairy, so too would have ours. We also stay up all night, the entire night, learning Torah. And the basic idea is that our ancestors, they all fell asleep, and God had to wake them up from their slumber on the morning on which they were going to receive the Torah. Really, they should have been so excited that they shouldn't have been able to sleep. So we, in turn, kind of make up for that, and we don't sleep the night before we re-experience the receiving of the Torah. Another thing that made Shavuot interesting and special is that it was the first day that you would bring the new fruit offerings to the temple, the Bikurim they're called, and it really was the holiday that fell out dedicated to the threshing of the agriculture. Okay. The last thing just to point out is it's a beautiful concept that when we receive the Torah describes that we were ki'ish echad b'lev echad, like one person with one heart. In other words, in order to be worthy of receiving the Torah, in order to have the Torah, to truly experience a relationship with God and the Torah, we need to be united. So it's a very important thing to think about on the holiday of Shavuot. Okay, so as we came out of Egypt, we had 49 days till we received the Torah, and then we ended up having 40 more years in the desert. We weren't supposed to have 40 years in the desert. We were supposed to get the Torah and then go to Israel, and it should have been, a less than 2-week journey. But the story with the spies, the Jewish spies, they went to spy out the land of Israel. They came back with a horrible report. And when everyone heard it, heard this report, the Jews lost faith in their ability to go into Israel. They thought they would be vanquished by enemies. And because they lost that faith, God in turn said, you as a generation will not be going into the land of Israel. Rather, we'll spend 40 years in the desert, and it'll be your children's generation that will go into the land of Israel. Okay. So, but during those 40 years, the Jewish people were protected. And that is where the holiday of Sukkot comes in. On the holiday of Sukkot, we build a booth, an outdoor booth. The roof needs to be thatched because we're under God's protection. We don't rely on human protection to remember that we're under God's protection, because in the desert, we were protected by God. And maybe the sukkah, the booth, reminds us, commemorates God's protection in the form of the clouds of glory, the protective clouds that were all around us that would protect us from the elements. Or perhaps it was about the God's protection in the booths that we made for ourselves in the desert. But whatever it is, we reflect on God's protection, how we would not be able to exist without God's oversight. Again, in the Torah, and therefore in Israel, Sukkot is a 7-day holiday, with an eighth day attached to it that is referred to as Shemini Atzeres, the eighth day of gathering. Basically, you have your 7 days of Sukkot, and then you have this unique eighth day holiday called Shemini Atzeres, which is basically, which is basically a time, a little fascinating little day that's about the intimate relationship between God and the Jews. The seventh day of Sukkot is called Hoshana Rabbah, which is the end of the judgment period that began on Rosh Hashanah. And we'll talk more about that soon. So that's what it would look like in Israel. So in Israel, you would have a seven-day Sukkot, an eighth day of Shmini Atzeret, and then that eighth day would also be celebrated as Simchat Torah. Before I explain that a little bit more, I want to talk about, though, that in the diaspora, we end up having a 7 days of Sukkot, and then we have an eighth day called Shmini Atzeret, and because of the confusion of the diaspora, we have to add a ninth day, right, one extra day, and that becomes Simchat Torah. So in Israel, Simchat Torah and Shmini Atzeret are the same day, and in the diaspora, they're two separate days. What exactly is Simchat Torah? Simchat Torah is the day of celebrating the completing and then the starting again of the reading of the Torah in its yearly cycle of reading. So in Simchat Torah, we finish the Torah reading for the year, the entire Torah, and we also begin anew. It's a very special time. Okay, so on Sukkot as well, we just got to make sure we talk about some of the other things about Sukkot. The other very important mitzvah of Sukkot is the waving, the taking of the four species. On Sukkot, we take four species. The etrog, the citrus fruit, the hadassim, the myrtle branch, the willow, the aravot in Hebrew, and the lulav, the palm frond. And we bind it all together, and we make a blessing, and we take it and we shake it a little bit. And there are many reasons for why we have these four species that we bring together. One of the ideas is that they represent all different types of Jews, and we bind them together again, an ode to Jewish unity. Sukkot is also the time, the harvest festival, which makes it a perfect time to be sitting out in the elements, because the harvest itself, right? We could, once we have this big, beautiful harvest, we could begin to think that things are completely in our hands. So we sit outside in the elements to remember that that in order for anything to happen, we need God as our partner. Okay. So that's the end of the Shalosh Regalim, the three festivals. Now let's talk about four other festivals. Two of them are biblical. We're going to first talk about Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, the first day of Tishrei, the day on which Adam and Eve were created. So truly the anniversary of the creation of humankind. And it would make sense, therefore, that on the anniversary of the creation of humankind, it would be the day on which God takes stock of God's creation of humankind. So in other words, Rosh Hashanah is our day for our Creator to take stock of us and for us to take stock of our own lives. We refer to Rosh Hashanah as Yom HaDin, Judgment Day, but the prayers of Rosh Hashanah don't reflect what we would think of when we would think of Yom HaDin, Judgment Day. When we would think of Judgment Day, you would think that our prayers would have a lot of repentance, regret, apologies, teshuva, repentance. And yet, there's very little of that on Rosh Hashanah. The theme that runs through the prayer service of Rosh Hashanah is actually the idea of Malchus, Malchut. God is sovereign. We repeat this concept over and over again on Rosh Hashanah. In fact, some refer to it as the Coronation Day. It's the day that we coronate God as our sovereign. So how do Coronation Day and Judgment Day work in tandem? So perhaps the idea is that when we talk about Judgment Day, God's not judging us on our past behavior, but rather on our commitment to the future. What, after we take stock on Rosh Hashanah, what does our commitment to the future look like? And what are we committing to? What is being analyzed? Well, we're thinking about the commitment to God as our sovereign. Is our life going forward going to reflect having answering or being committed to this higher power, to God as our sovereign? So we take stock by constantly reiterating this God, coronating God as our sovereign. And in turn, that helps us reflect on what the year ahead is going to be looking like. And then in turn, God will analyze us to see what does our future look like. And then obviously on Rosh Hashanah, we have the shofar blowing. The shofar is a wake-up call so that we start thinking more about these things. It also can be understood as the trumpets of those mass rallies of coronation. We eat apples and honey on Rosh Hashanah and other auspicious foods. Very interesting. And as I said, there are in the Musaf prayer, which is the additional prayer for Rosh Hashanah, it's broken up into three parts: Malchios, Zichronos, and Shofros. Malchios, again, verses and prayers of kingship, sovereignty. Zichronos, which is all about how God analyzes and remembers us. We are aware that God is aware of our lives, these expressions of love, how much God cares about each one of us. And it's our time to recommit to a loving God. And then we have the Shofaros, which are verses and prayers that talk and speak about the shofar, that are interspersed with sounds of the shofar to really wake us up and get us going. And then between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we have what are known as the 10 days of repentance, the Aseret Yemei Teshuvah, the period of time between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, which leads us to Yom Kippur, which is a day of repentance, regret, forgiveness. That is a day about the past. So in Rosh Hashanah, we commit to a certain type of future, and we don't want to get bogged down by the past in order to commit to a better future. But on Yom Kippur, we do endeavor to fix the parts that are broken. We do look at our past to help fix so that we are more whole going forward. It's on this day that we ask forgiveness of God, and it's on this day that we also do not receive God's forgiveness unless we've also received the forgiveness of our fellow human beings. Okay, and again, based on what we were saying, it's the light, it's that same concept of light that we are tapping into. Rosh Hashanah is the day of creation. It's that day of renewal. It's a day of a clean slate. It's a date of a bright future ahead of us. And Yom Kippur, which is Yom Kippur, which by the way is known as Shabbat Shabbaton, the Shabbat of all Shabbats, on Yom Kippur, that was the day. So don't forget. So on the 17th of the Hebrew month of Tammuz, that's when the Jewish people worship the golden calf after receiving the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai. And God wanted to completely absolve the relationship that existed between the Jewish people and God. Moses interceded on our behalf. And it was on Yom Kippur of that year that Moses comes down with the second tablets, in other words, making it very clear that the Jewish people were forgiven, and not just forgiven, but it was that relationship between us and God was fixed. And that light of forgiveness and being able to repair relationships is accessible to us on Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur begins with that age-old melody and prayer called Kol Nidre, which is about us absolving ourselves of our vows. There are five things that we don't do on Yom Kippur. It's five things we abstain from on Yom Kippur, but we'll talk more about that in our fast day class. Throughout Yom Kippur, we also have our confessions. We constantly are doing the confessions. And what we also do is we also have a big chunk of the prayer service dedicated to the Avodah, dedicated to retelling of the service that was done in the Holy Temple in Jerusalem on Yom Kippur. It was the holiest service of the year, and we retell it and re-experiencing it every single year. And of course, Yom Kippur finishes off with a prayer service called Ne'ilah, the closing of the gate, one of the most emotionally charged prayer services of the year. So now we've gotten through our biblical festivals, our three pilgrimage festivals: Passover, Pesach, Shavuot and Sukkot, and then our two other festivals, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Now, let's talk about the two rabbinic holidays before we call it a day. The first rabbinic holiday that I want to talk about is Purim. Purim happens after the Jewish people have had the luxury of living in Israel as a nation for 850 years. After those 850 years, the first temple in Jerusalem, which had been standing for 410 years, is destroyed, and the Jewish people are exiled to Babylonia and Persia. And you could only imagine, the temple's in ruins, no prophecy, no land, they don't have a land anymore, no temple. Jeremiah the prophet had said that 70 years would pass and the Jewish people would return to Israel. And it seems, according to all the calculations, that 70 years had passed. Things could not have gotten, seemingly in the minds of the Jews living in Babylonia and Persia at that time, things could not have gotten any worse. Then the king of Persia makes a big banquet to celebrate the 70 years having passed and basically having permanently destroyed Israel. And he celebrates with vessels of the temple, which is an extremely desecration. And then 9 years pass after that, and Ahasuerus, the king, appoints Haman, the wicked, as his second in command. Mordechai, the Jew, will not bow to Haman, although the law is everyone has to bow to Haman. Haman convinces Ahasuerus to commit genocide against the entire Jewish people. And at that point, you can only imagine that if the Jews had been dejected before that, imagine how depressed they were at that point. But because of a sequence of events, Ahasuerus' queen happened to be Jewish, Queen Esther, and the plot of genocide is foiled. Haman and his henchmen are killed. Mordechai becomes the viceroy, and not too many years later, the Jews return to Israel. So Purim, the holiday of Purim, celebrates the foiling of the plot of genocide, and the salvation of the Jewish people. The day before Purim is a fast day. It's called Tanis Esther, which we'll talk more about in our fast day discussion. On Purim, we listen to the story of Purim, which as written down in Megillat Esther, the Megillah of Esther. We read it twice, once at night, once during the day. Interestingly, the name of God is not mentioned in the Megillah, which points out how Purim is a celebration of God in the hidden, right? Even when we may not see God, God is there orchestrating events and watching out for the Jewish people. We foster unity on Purim through Mishloach Manot, giving gifts of food to our friends, and Matanot Le'evyonim, which are gifts of money to the poor so that they can provide, so that everyone has the ability to make a Purim Su'uda. Another mitzvah of Purim is to have a big festive meal. And then, of course, we also wear costumes on Purim. Costumes is about masking a reality. Purim was that time where God was masked, but certainly working behind the scenes. You could have explained away the Purim miracle as random, but if you pay any sort of attention and are an intellectual person, it's hard to explain away all of what happened is just mere coincidence. So that's what Purim's about, and then we get to our last rabbinic holiday, which is Hanukkah. Hanukkah takes us to the year 167 BCE, 167 before the Common Era, and it celebrates the Jewish victory over the Greek Empire, the Maccabees, against the Greeks. The Greeks threatened the Jewish people with assimilation. They represented everything physical. The traditional Jews represented the spiritual, but they couldn't tolerate the spiritual, that Jewish way of life. Many Jews assimilated, became Hellenized. They adopted the Greek culture, but a group of traditional Jews would not, led by Matisyahu, a Hellenist. Matisyahu, the leader, was commanded to slaughter a pig. He, of course, wouldn't do it. A Hellenist would. That was too much for Matisyahu at that point. A war broke out between the Maccabees, the traditionalist Jews, against the Greek soldiers and the Hellenized Jews on the other side. And miraculously, a very small army of traditional Jews, the Maccabees, and three were able to vanquish, at least temporarily, the Greek army. And 3 years after the beginning of the war, they were able to retake control of the temple in Jerusalem. They wanted to light the menorah, but they only were able to find pure olive oil for one day. It miraculously stayed lit for 8 days. We light the Hanukkah menorah for 8 days. It's a holiday for 8 days. The word Hanukkah means dedication, because that's when we rededicated the temple after it had been completely desecrated by the Greeks and the Hellenized Jews. We add a candle each night. We go up. We eat oily foods because of the role that oil played in the Hanukkah miracle and in the Hanukkah festival. And of course, we also play dreidel. Dreidel goes back to this time where we weren't allowed to learn Torah. Traditional Jews weren't allowed to learn Torah. And if a Greek or a Hellenized Jew came in and saw people learning Torah, that could be on the risk of death. So what happened is that they would learn Torah, and then if the alarms would sound, if someone was coming that they did not want them to know was learning Torah, and they'd switch to playing with these tops with the dreidels, and that's why we have dreidels till this day. And that is a little bit about Hanukkah. So what I hope to do today was I shared how Jewish time works, cyclical, not linear. I talked about the way the calendar works. It's not a solar calendar, it's not a lunar calendar, it's a combination. How months are made, festivals, each went through the biblical festivals and the rabbinic festivals, why there's different, why sometimes it's 7 days, sometimes 8 days. And I hope you enjoy this podcast, and the next one will be about fast days, the Jewish fast days. Thank you so much for listening.